Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Culligan Water of Cache Valley, family-owned and operated for more than 62 years, providing Culligan bottled water, salt delivery, or soft and conditioned water. Hey Culligan Man service from the man in blue. Online at logan.culliganman.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn.
I'm Laura Pritchett, and I'm in Bellevue, Colorado, site of recent flooding.
Pritchett is the author and editor of 6 books and has a novel forthcoming in 2014. She has published over 100 essays and short stories in magazines, including Salon, Orion, The Sun, and others. Her novel, Skybridge, won the Willa Fiction Award, and the short story collection, Hell's Bottom in Colorado, won the Milkweed National Fiction Prize and the Penn USA Award.
My most recent book was about Colorado's bears, and that was a nonfiction book. But mostly I write fiction. All of my novels have been set in contemporary Colorado, and I hope they take the Western mythos to task a bit and that they show the contemporary West as it really is. And so my fiction is very much set here, but I do a lot of nonfiction as well. I have 3 books of nonfiction, and they're all place-based about Colorado's rivers and grasslands and ranching and trying to make it work, because I love Colorado, and it leads to a certain amount of activism, I think, and a certain amount of trying to protect that which you love.
Pritchett lives up high in the foothills of Colorado. From her home, she watched and listened to the flood that recently drenched the region. She wrote about the event and the aftermath in the magazines On Earth and Salon. Today on the program, Pritchett discusses her personal account of the flood and its effects on the fracking fluid, and her activism in Colorado.
Our home was just fine, but walking a half a mile down to the river was just phenomenal to see all that flooding water. And at first it was so delightful because we had been in drought for some time and it had been dry and hot. And so the first few days of rain were really lovely. But then it became apparent that we were experiencing some kind of freak storm and an unusual weather pattern that had stalled over the area. And it just kept raining and raining and raining, and roads started to close and everything started to flood. And it was really something to see from both the ground and from high up in the air. I was able to go up in a small plane. But the huge cottonwoods cracking were just amazing. Cracking and falling into the rushing water, and hay stacks, hay bales rushing down the river, sticks, and much of the water was very black because of the recent wildfires that we had had last summer. So there was just a lot of sediment coming down and a lot of noise, plus the sound of the constant rain.
How has the landscape changed from the flood?
I grew up on a ranch nearby, and the ranch borders the Cache La Poudre River, and the landscape has changed quite dramatically alongside the banks. There are now islands where there were no islands and new sandy shores where there were not, and my parents lost some of their acreage. And certainly it was hard. That was hard to see, although beautiful too, because rivers need to flood, I think, from time to time. It's natural. Also, it was a little difficult in that the little town I live in called Bellevue was stranded from the outside world. Every road that we had out was blocked, or the National Guard was out stopping traffic, and we just couldn't leave.
How long were you trapped?
It was just a few days, and then, although still, if I try to drive into town now, the water is so high on one road I take into town that I have to, you know, we have to drive through a stream. Basically, a stream has just taken over the road in a low part, so everyone has to slow down and carefully get around it. We're lucky, though, in that we're not like Estes Park, which is truly stranded now, especially since the government shut down, and no one can get through Rocky Mountain National Park, because that was one of the few roads that people were able to get in and out of Estes Park, because that road up the canyon to Estes and Rocky Mountain National Park has been completely wiped out.
Pritchett says she is afraid of flying, but she braved a 4-seater plane flight in order to see the flooding aftermath.
I love this landscape. I'm literally in love with it. And all of my work, both fiction and nonfiction, is very place-based. And because I love that landscape, I feel like I end up doing some investigative journalism, and then that leads to activism. And so I was able to go up in an airplane flight sponsored by EcoFlight, and we were able to survey the damage during the flooding. And the most striking thing I saw, I suppose, were all the fracking wells that had spilled. In fact, the 15th spill has just been discovered. 43,000 gallons of oil has leaked into the river, and only a certain percentage of the fracking wells have even been examined. So this is really an important issue to me. I mean, I could see the black contaminants flowing into the river that I love. And it does make me think of those larger issues of the climate change. You know, I don't know if this was a 100-year storm or a 1,000-year storm, but certainly it was a freak storm. I don't know if anyone can say with certainty that it's directly contributed to climate change, but certainly there's something interesting going on, and we have to be smart about this, particularly, for example, one specific example, where we place these fracking wells, that we don't place them knowingly in floodplains, as has been done.
The bumpy ride offered despair and hope.
We were bumping around up there in the small aircraft, and at first I was struck with how beautiful it is. I mean, the Colorado Rockies are right there, and all this green pasture land, and everything was especially brilliant green because of all this rain. Normally we're quite yellow. The whole state is yellow this time of year, but it's been very, very green. And it's just so beautiful. But then we started flying over the flooding and, you know, seeing houses underwater and seeing cattle all smashed together on one little high area with floodwaters all around. You know, that is a little more difficult to see. And then the most disturbing thing was, of course, for me, was seeing the oil and gas wells clearly surrounded by water, many tanks tipped over, trucks, some semi-trucks, that were tipped over in the water, and just knowing that, you know, that there's chemicals in there, there's oil and gas and the products, and they're all leaking into the water.
And what is being done to mitigate the problems?
There are several things being done. One is that they're trying to contain the spilling. Again, 43,000 gallons have already spilled into the water, but they're trying to mitigate that. There are other more policy-oriented things. For example, there's a proposal on to impose a 5-year moratorium on building new fracking wells in the city of Fort Collins. I don't get to vote on that because I don't live in the city, but certainly many of the cities around here are starting to look at policy regarding this and basically to stop fracking until the state conducts studies on safety and where they're placed in light of this recent flooding.
I covered fracking a couple of years ago and visited West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, and the damage to the Appalachians was particularly clear and devastating, and there were numerous mudslides. And the ranch lands in the Uinta Basin were surrounded by the constant hum of fracking, pretty much 24 hours a day.
Actually, can I say one thing about that? I live near Weld County, and Weld County has 20,000 active oil and gas wells, and that's the highest density in the nation. So I know a lot of people think of the East Coast and some of those other places, but Weld County, right along this river, has actually the highest density in the nation.
Do you think it's getting enough media attention?
I do not. I think there's a small fraction of people who care a lot about this issue. And that's one reason I went up in the airplane and wanted to write an article for On Earth magazine, was to bring more attention to what I saw with my own eyes of, you know, these leaking fluids, this leaking oil right into the water that is our drinking water and also goes to croplands that feed much of the nation.
Bridget's love for Colorado's wilderness has inspired her to write extensively and report on the environmental issues there. It also calls her to action.
Once somebody said to me, it was the greatest compliment of my life, they said, oh, you're Colorado's Terry Tempest Williams or Rick Bass, which made me laugh because they're two of my great heroes. But I feel like I consider myself a fiction writer and a teacher, but I just am so in love with this landscape that I've felt compelled to spend a lot of my time working to preserve it. It really bothers me that we lose so much acreage every moment to development, and that fracking wells are built on floodplains, and that our wildlife is often under duress. And so I get involved in several issues and writing for publications such as On Earth, which is the NRDC's magazine, and for High Country News and other publications that I feel are able to give voice to some of these issues.
Next, Pritchett reads an excerpt from her recent article titled Washed Away, published in On Earth and Salon. She starts from the beginning.
This rainstorm came quietly. No rolling thunder, no booming lightning. It whisked in silently, without nature's warnings and without any 911 calls to alert. Perhaps it's the hush of it, in fact, that heightened my hearing. These last few days, I've become hyper-attuned to the sounds of this massive storm, to all the dialects of rain, to the languages of water, to the human sounds that this moisture has put into motion. The National Guard, for instance, has stationed outside my house, men with weapons, huge flood lamps, large trucks. But it's the noises, not the visuals, which I notice. It's the hum of their generator that lulls me to sleep at night, wakes me in the morning. Sometimes I can hear the men speaking, a little murmur of the words that remind me of a stream. I listen to the lack of traffic. I live on a small road at the base of Colorado's mountains, and we residents of this little unincorporated town are stranded. Thus, the roads are deserted. There's nowhere to go. Through the rain, I see a few folks walk to the post office, a few to the Grange. That is all we have. But the rest of us stay inside, looking out. I decide that I could, in an emergency, sneak out the old ditch road, as I call it, but I know that if I make it out, I'll likely not be able to get back in. I learned this lesson last summer during the fire evacuations. Better to stay at home with work and food and pets rather than to be aimless and homeless. So my neighbors and I, we stay inside our homes, unable or unwilling to go. The rain, of course, is the constant sound. It just keeps coming.
Richard explains how the event changed interactions among neighbors and communities.
Like many disasters, I think this one brought us all together, and there were jokes about, you know, we have chickens, so we had eggs, and other people had wine or cheese, and there's a dairy up the road, and so we were all thinking that if this storm really did leave us stranded for a long period of time, you know, that we could share resources. And just knowing that you live in a community small enough to do that, it's pretty joyful. We only have one post office and one Grange. We don't have any. We used to have a coffee shop, but they quit. So we're pretty alone here. And it felt good to get to know the neighbors again. And a similar thing happened last year during the wildfires when we were all evacuating and we're sharing resources about where to take people's horses or cows or stuff. And so it's a pretty close, beautiful community. I really love it here. And it's quiet now. The waters have gone down, and except for having to drive through a small stream to get into Fort Collins, we're all back to our normal lives. Certainly some people in the nearby town of La Porte had their houses flooded, and I know the Red Cross has pitched in to help, and FEMA is there, and people, National Guard was here and then left, but people have been pitching in to help clean up other people's gardens and flooded basements and so on, so... It's just a community being a community.
Do you remember worrying about natural disasters as a child, and did you see any floods or fires?
There was a flood that I remember vaguely, but it was nothing like this flood, and there certainly weren't wildfires. I don't remember worrying so much about that big picture. I suppose my big worry back then was nuclear war, which was a big part of my childhood worry. But my children really experienced the world differently. They have a box of their most important things boxed up, ready to be evacuated. They've been evacuated once in the middle of the night, and they know about the wildfires that continue to spark and blaze around here, and now flooding. So I've always considered Colorado a very consoling place, a very happy place, and I hope that they grow up with that feeling too, because it is a beautiful landscape. It's just that we've had our fair share of trials lately.
What stories and concerns are you hearing from others about the flood?
There's some interesting stories that have come out of this flood. I guess one was that my brother just found a 24-inch rainbow trout sitting in a ditch that normally wouldn't have fish in it, but because of all the flooding, trout from the nearby fish hatchery ended up in there. So that's been fun. He just reached in and grabbed it because it was dying because the water was going down. So we had a nice rainbow trout meal. So there have been some good things about this storm and some bad things. The good things are that everything is so emerald green and we're no longer in a drought. We got 8 inches of rain in a few days, and that's half of our annual waterfall. And the river got washed out. It's running much cleaner now. All the sediment from the fires, all the ash and black sediment has been washed out. So all that is really great. Some of the harder things are knowing that we can't get to Rocky Mountain National Park and that some of the bridges in town are still out and that people are still displaced and that some of the water quality is still at issue. And then, of course, for me, the fracking wells is the largest concern.
Bridget writes with focus and vision. She blends wildlife, ranching, and culture into her eye-opening work. In her collection of stories called Hell's Bottom in Colorado, Bridget writes of the hard work and casual cruelty of ranch life.
Well, I hate to get all philosophical on you, but I am. I think it's an artist's main job to never avert her eyes. And I have it up on my computer in front of me, in fact, right now. It says, never avert your eyes. And by that, I mean, look at something as it really is and tell the truth about it. And so although I grew up on a ranch and there was so much care and love that went into animal husbandry and taking care of the land, there's also a certain amount of cruelty that happens by the very nature of life, you know, calves dying, calves being shot, being disfigured, and that sort of thing. And I've tried to look at the West, both at ranch life and just the real culture of the West, with as much clarity and honesty as I can, and that's both tender and cruel.
Ranching seems to be a life way on the fringes of society now, and several ranchers I've talked to during the course of my reporting have been forced to take other jobs because they can barely eke out a living through ranching, and at a time when local sustainable agriculture is so important for the environment, are we moving in the wrong direction?
Absolutely. I grew up on a ranch, and I love ranches, and I have chickens now, and my parents still own their ranch, and I stop by to help put up hay or feed the animals and so on. So I'm really enamored with that life, and I think certainly if we're going to be a culture that eats meat, we need to support ranches. The problem with so many areas in the West is that they're beautiful, and so people move there and buy up that ranch land and develop it, and not all of that is bad. People need a place to live, but certainly ranches in this area are rapidly being replaced by subdivisions and other enterprises. I did one book called Homeland Ranching in a West That Works for exactly that reason, because I think all Americans, whether they live in the city or the country or left or right politically, they care about space and these places and these healthy ecosystems, and to have fracking move in or to have subdivisions replace, that's a heartbreaker.
Bridget's two teens motivate her to write and speak out.
Certainly there have been nights that I felt exhausted to the point of tears from working in the activism and sitting in meetings that I didn't want to sit in. And then I look at them and it gives me a renewed sense of mission and of energy, and that might be cliche, but it's true. I would really like to see them grow up in a world that wasn't so dependent on fossil fuels, and I would like them to grow up in a Colorado that still has open places and spaces and healthy ecosystems. And so I do feel like some of my fighting energy, or much of my fighting energy, comes from my hope for their future.
Bridget has a new novel called Stars Go Blue to be released in June by Counterpoint Press.
So in this novel, we meet the hardscrabble ranchers, Rennie and Ben Cross. And in this novel, they are estranged elderly spouses living on opposite ends of their sprawling Colorado ranch. And Ben has Alzheimer's, and he's struggling with the diagnosis. He's just been diagnosed. And he's just at the cusp of dementia, able to recognize that he's sick, but unable to do anything about it. And he writes himself notes and leaves them around the house to try to remember what to do. And right as he's trying to cope with that, he learns that Ray, who was a character named Ray, who was the abusive husband of their daughter and who shot her dead in the family kitchen, is being released from prison early. So this news opens up all kinds of wounds for Ben and his wife and his surviving daughter and his four grandchildren. And so he has this need for justice, and he has to act fast before his mind leaves him. And so he sets off during a brutal snowstorm to confront the man who murdered his daughter. And his wife and his main caretaker, Rennie, realizes he's missing. And although they've been living on opposite ends of the ranch and haven't gotten along for years and have been semi-divorced or semi-separated, she comes to realize that she needs to help him and help her husband in this final act of trying to die well or find justice before he goes. And so this is a little bit from Stars Go Blue. And this is from the point of view of Ben. The fields are poured ice, rippled and waved. Ben considers the way the sun has melted and the earth absorbed the snow that fell months ago, which is how such strange patterns got created. But he also entertains the idea that his pastures have reverted in time to the great sea they once were. Ben has been partial to water, always, which is why life gets measured in terms of irrigation and rainfall and acre feet and even the dry, rainless days needed for baling hay. Even now, he considers the watersheds of his brain, how water moves through tissue, how rivers of electricity pulse and stops and starts. The pastures have never been this way, so icy, and it makes walking hard. There are no cattle to check, no fields to irrigate, nothing to doctor or wean or birth, and yet he wants to walk anyway, down this iced-over dirt road to the back of his ranch, even though walking is tough because this year the snow has not melted like it should. He has that memory thing. He can't remember the name, and he knows it's normal to be able to remember his childhood, but not yesterday, and not, on occasion, his wife's name, or the name of the daughter walking beside him. He's not supposed to feel bad about the things he can't remember, although he is allowed to feel bad about the fact that this disease only gets worse. And deeper still, he has clarified that he's allowed the terror and the claustrophobia of wanting to say words that are dammed up inside.
That was Colorado-based author Laura Pritchett. Thank you for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn, Susie Montgomery, and Elaine Taylor.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away. On the road, hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast, and it don't last for long.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank.
This week, learn about the secret Japanese air attacks on the United States mainland during World War II. First this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
The Japanese bombing of Hawaii's Pearl Harbor brought the United States into World War II in 1941. But one of the best-kept secrets of the war was a Japanese air offensive on the U.S. mainland using fire balloon bombs, some of which actually reached Utah. Starting in November 1944, Japan launched 9,000 hydrogen balloons laden with bombs that drifted in the high-altitude jet stream more than 6,000 miles across the Pacific Ocean to North America. Constructed of handmade paper and starch paste, each balloon carried a payload meant to damage cities, farms, and forests. Of the 1,000 balloons thought to have reached North America, fewer than 300 were actually sighted. Most balloons were found along the Pacific coast and in the Intermountain West, but some traveled as far inland as Michigan. 5 balloons are known to have landed in Utah, including 2 reported in Box Elder County and 1 each in Morgan, Duchesne, and Iron counties. Luckily, these did not explode in populated areas, but Box Elder County Sheriff Warren Hyde did acquire a few bruises in his attempt to wrestle one balloon to the ground. The lawman got a free ride when he clung to the balloon's ropes as it drifted and bounced him along for half a mile. The U.S. government prohibited the media from reporting balloon sightings in order to stem public panic and deny Japan information about the impact of their attack. The War Department feared the balloons might carry deadly diseases or even soldiers. It wasn't until six people in Oregon were killed by one of the bombs that the government finally confirmed the existence of the fire balloons and warned people to steer clear of them. Other than the Oregon deaths, damage from the fire balloons was minor. Discouraged by the apparent failure of the effort, Japan halted its balloon attacks in April 1945, 4 months before the end of the war. Sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.